For the week of March 15th, 2021, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 485, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I just got back from New York. I'm Michael Giltz. But what year is this? I thought it was 2020.
What did I say? 2021?
Yes, yes.
Yes, so you did catch that. Yes, I am canceling 2020. Oh. I'm done with it. I want it to be over.
Well, I'm sure Tom Hanks feels the same way. I love the fact that Tom Hanks getting the worldwide news. Worldwide news. Tom Hanks has the coronavirus. That's stardom, baby. Tom Hanks and his wife, Rita Wilson, have the coronavirus. God, we hope they're okay. They're in Australia. They're fine. They're getting the best care possible. I'm sure they'll be just fine. They're strong, healthy people. I'm sure it'll all work out well for them. But that tells you, even in the midst of all the chaos and all the things happening, and the Dow Jones plunging and France is shutting down for 2 weeks, Tom Hanks gets sick. We're going to hear about it.
A couple points there about Tom Hanks. Number one, I am never traveling with that guy. Okay.
Why?
Because he's either getting stranded on an island or he's getting stranded in space, Apollo 13.
Or his U-boat is getting attacked by battalion or platoon of ships is getting attacked by a U-boat submarines in World War II.
Yeah. Or, you know, look at his boat is his plane is going down. The captain, I am the captain. The boat movie. I mean, look, the guy just does not do well with transportation. Things go wrong when he moves.
You should have looked up the names if you were going to make all those jokes.
Yes, I should have. That would have been much better.
You were going to do that.
I had no idea I was going to do that. I didn't know I was going to be doing a lot of things this past week.
That's right. I just got back from New York where I voted for the IRAs, my annual movie get-together, our best film of 2019. End of the Century. What a scary name that is now. But it's an Argentinian film about two men who meet each other and go out on a date together. It's got an odd elliptical, almost Twilight Zone feel to it. It's alternate streams of reality, actually. But it's essentially a two-hander. It's a very nice film. I was very happy to see that one. And our favorite documentary was the Oscar winner, American Factory.
Ah, what about Honeyland?
That was number two. I was pushing it hard. I wanted that to win Best Picture even. That is one of the saddest movies I have ever seen. It's 90 minutes. It's like, let's make a short, modest film that encapsulates the entire world and how society behaves and what happens to. I mean, it's just unreal. What a remarkable story they got. It's a lovely, sad film. Beautiful looking, heart-wrenching, well worth your 90 minutes.
Remember when I saw that film and we talked about it right here on the show?
I do.
And I said, I cannot believe this film. It's one of the best films I've seen in a very long time. Mm-hmm. I could not believe it. I still, whenever I revisit like portions of it, I'm like, how is it that they managed to get this film over 3 years? They follow this woman in the middle of nowhere. She lives in the middle of nowhere.
And everything happens imaginable. It's just amazing. But you know, it's well worth your 90 minutes. And so is our podcast.
Which will probably be 90 minutes.
What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we really would love to deliver our usual menu of box office and feature stories, our patented roundup of news via Big Deal or Big Whoop. You know, maybe a savvy and insightful inside baseball followed by obituaries and, you know, some witty kicker that can, you know, like our normal show. But sadly, we'll be talking about coronavirus like everybody else in the world. First, we'll cover the worldwide box office, such as it is, which is not very much. Then we'll be joined by our special guest, Variety editor Andrew Wallenstein, to talk about the film industry and how they're dealing with the you know, COVID-19, coronavirus, and he's joining us at the very last minute. He wrote a column 2 minutes ago, literally, saying this crisis should lead to studios and exhibitors collapsing the window between theatrical and video on demand. Lo and behold, just as we were preparing to go on the air, guess what? Universal Pictures has done exactly that. So I guess he's got a lot of sway here in Los Angeles or the entertainment industry. But first, you know, as always, we always turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
Is that last week's box office or is that the last box office ever? So that's what it feels like a little bit because France has just shut down for 2 weeks. That'll be old news to you listening. But we are looking at box office around the world. A few unlucky films really opened up just now, and their box office is going to be forever diminished, and there will be an asterisk by their name. So we'll never know what they might have done. But we are looking at box office around the world, and the number one film is Pixar's Onward. This is one of the films that I said, hey, you know what? Never count out Pixar. They're going to push this movie. It's got big stars like Tom Holland. Who knows where it will end up? Well, we know now it's not going to end up great because box office is just shutting down. But it made $33 million this week. It's at $101 million worldwide and counting. They were certainly hoping for $600 million, which is what Pixar makes almost automatically these days. They're not going to get anywhere near that, I fear.
Well, you know, part of the problem with this, this coronavirus, and okay, yes, the health problems, but for the entertainment industry, part of the problem will always be when people are reporting on Pixar films, they'll always say, well, such and such did below, you know, they'll start comparing it to other Pixar films, and this one will always be the outlier. You almost have to throw it out. Onward, you can never compare, you know, Onward or any Pixar film to Onward because Onward will always be
Dinosaur.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And of course, as we're talking about the show, our perspective is about the industry and all the various areas of entertainment and how it's going to affect them. But of course, nothing matters more than people's health. And of course, the employees matter. We're looking at things at a macro level, like film studios and TV networks and stuff like that. But of course, it's the ticket takers and the production assistants and the guy who makes popcorn and the person who is working at your local cable company is going to be hurt really hard by all of this, of course. So we know that that's what matters most of all, but we are just looking at this stuff at a sort of a macro level. But again,
yeah, but we are practicing social distancing. In fact, we were about 10 years ahead of the curve because we've been recording in separate places for years.
That's right. So Onward is at number one. It made $33 million and it passed the $100 million mark. And number two is a new film. It's Vin Diesel's Bloodshot. It's based on a video game. It made $24 million on its opening week. Not a bad opening, especially when you consider what might have been. It only cost $45 million to make. It's probably not going to get to $130 or $40 million just because of what's going on. But it was a pretty good launch, especially under the straitened circumstances. This is another movie that might have worked or even launched a franchise. We'll never know. We do know that The Invisible Man is a hit. That movie made $24 million this week. It's at $120 million worldwide. At number four is Sonic the Hedgehog. That made another $11 million, and it passed the $300 million mark. At number five is Baagi 3. That's a Bollywood film starring Tiger Shroff. That made another $10 million in its second week. It's at $17 million and counting. It's a big, dumb action film that can take your mind off your worries. We do know that in India, pretty much all of film and TV production seems to have been shut down. At number six, another new film here in North America, it's I Still Believe. It's a film about that Christian popular song, I Still Believe, and the origin story behind it. It opened up to $9 million. That's a great opening because it only costs $10 million to make. Now, what's that a film about a young woman getting an abortion? Sometime, never, I get it always wrong.
Never, sometimes, never, rarely, sometimes, always.
And are you right? Never really, sometimes always. You're right. That's from Focus Features. That opened up this week, too, on four screens. It made a modest $4,000 per screen. Obviously, New York and LA, very hard hit already by the shutdowns. And now we know that the theaters in New York and LA have shut down completely. So that movie did not do well. And you cannot say that I Still Believe beat it fair and square. But the Christians who are, you know, pro-life can say, aha, look at that. I Still Believe beat out Never, Sometimes, Forever, Always. So a little triumph for the born-again Christians. At number six is The Call of the Wild, another $8 million. That's at $107 million worldwide. I think the script was already written for that one. This movie was not going to be a success, but they can claim, hey, who knows? You know, how do we know? Then there's The Hunt. Here's a real wild card. This was a movie that was scheduled to be released. Then it was pulled. Now it's being released again. It's red states versus blue states, just when we all got to come together. It opened to $6 million. And we think, oh, boy, another missed opportunity, but maybe not, because Universal is taking drastic action and The Hunt will be involved in that. At number nine is Emma. That made another $5 million. That's a $25 million worldwide. That's a solid debut for director Autumn DeWilde. We'll have to chalk that up as a winner, no matter where it ends up. Guy Ritchie did fine. His new gangster flick, The Gentleman, is at $115 million worldwide. Ben Affleck was looking for a serious comeback with The Way Back. That made $4 million. It's at $13 million worldwide. That, too, is going to fall through the cracks. Not My Spy. My Spy is a film that opened up in Australia. Now it's opening up in the UK. Clearly, the legs will be cut out from under it in those two markets. It's only at $5 million worldwide. But it's David Bautista, right?
It's yes, it is. Silly comedy. David Batista.
Yeah,
yes.
Him and a little girl. He's a big assassin or CIA guy, and she gets him to train her how to deal with bullies, and it's adorable and funny. It cost $18 million to make, so it's pennies on the dollar, and it's going to be released in North America. They have pulled it, and they are delaying it. This may be one of the films that becomes a video-on-demand special. Who knows? We'll get to that soon, but if they wait, I think this movie will prove a winner. And then I went and looked in India, and the gay Indian Bollywood film Shubh Mangal, et cetera, I apologize for messing that up. That made $2 million this week. That's at $11 million worldwide. When you look at the Comscore charts, we pulled in a few other movies. I think the chart had 11 or 12 movies on it, and it was very low scoring. In fact, the North American box office is at a 22-year low. It only grossed a total of $55 million across the entire country. As you know, one movie can make that in one weekend easily, double that, triple that. So that is a shocker. What we've been seeing in China for weeks, just zero box office, that's about to happen in North America.
Yeah, I wish I could say that I knew what was going to happen.
Well,
but
we do. The movie theaters are going to shut down across the country, essentially. We can see already cinemas across Europe are shutting down. Poland, Lebanon, Kuwait, and parts of Indian cinema closed for several weeks. France has just shut down the entire country for 2 weeks. AMC and Regal were trying to cap attendance. They're saying, okay, we'll let people come to the movies, but you can only fill 50% of the seats so people can be safe and have social distancing. But movies in Pennsylvania and New Jersey are partially shut down. More movies are moving. Every minute you turn around, there's an announcement of a new movie. Of course, we had things like Pearl Jam canceled their tour. Forget it. All tours.
Well, they didn't cancel it. They postponed it. But well, yes.
Yeah, they canceled their current tour. They postponed it, whatever you want to call it. They're not touring right now. But of course, now all touring is over. We were going to say March Madness, the basketball, was going to continue without crowds. But nope, it's been canceled. And in fact, all sports have been canceled. The NBA suspended their season. NHL suspended their season piece by piece. And now pretty much everything is up in the air. Baseball, you name it. Everything has been canceled, postponed, however you want to term it.
If you want to watch a never-ending string of poker, turn on ESPN.
CinemaCon is finally canceled. Mulan was finally delayed. All the big festivals like Coachella and Stagecoach are delaying. TV shows are taping without a live audience, and now they're just not going to be taping at all. TV upfronts have been canceled. Theme parks have been closed. We just had a list as long as your arm, but we can take some heart. Shanghai Disneyland is reopened with some restrictions on crowds and certain sections not opening yet. So they are perhaps at the other end of where we are at right now. They're 2 months in the future in terms of where we could be 2 months from now or 3 months from now, depending on how this all pans out. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. But I would love to talk about insurance. We were talking about insurance, and you talked about Cannes, and you talked about
South by Southwest. Really.
It turns out, just like South by Southwest, Cannes has announced that they have no insurance for disease-related cancellations. But that story doesn't end there. Shockingly, their insurance company reached out to them and said, hey, you're not covered for this. And 10 days before this article ran, they said, hey, look, do you want to be covered for disease-related stoppages? And Cannes reportedly said no. The cost would be 6% of their annual coverage. It would have been a 6% surcharge. They declined that offer, which means whatever you think the government of France might do for Cannes or how they would want to help it and make sure that this important institution in France continues and doesn't suffer some catastrophic blow financially, they're going to have a lot less sympathy if this story turns out to be true.
Well, so what they also said was that for a 6% bump in their annual coverage, they would have been capped at $2 million for a $32 million event. And they said, well,
the dollar amount doesn't work for us.
Yeah, exactly. They said, for that rate, we might as well just hold on to the money that we would have paid you and, you know, just weather the storm.
But what's their annual coverage? 6% of it is not $2 million, I imagine. So why not?
I don't know.
If it was more than $2 million, it would make sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we haven't heard any more news about South by Southwest. We know that they're not covered. We don't know what the circumstances are. We assume that they're telling the truth when they say they're not covered because we have no information otherwise.
No, I have no new information other than what I was told last week by bookers, which is, of course, they're trying to mitigate any expenses from people looking for their guarantees.
But hopefully not by lying. But anyway, there's a lot to talk about. And we thought in the next few weeks, there's going to be a trickle of news. We're certainly not going to have worldwide box office to talk about. So we thought we would look at the entertainment business category by category and say, hey, look, what are the short-term and long-term impacts of what's happening. Try to catch our breath. And instead of saying, this has been canceled, that has been canceled, try to take a long view. And we've got a great guest to kick that off with, don't we?
Yes. In fact, I read this piece last night by Andrew Wallenstein, the co-editor-in-chief of Variety. And it was a piece that, well, the headline kind of says it all. And it was the headline, Frozen 2 teases Disney potential to rattle the rigid windows of film biz. And it was written by Andrew Wallenstein. And it basically talks about that pretty much now is an opportune moment for studios and exhibitors to restart their premium VOD talks. So I reached out to Andrew and he was willing to join us. So Andrew, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, that's right, Andrew. The news is happening so fast. You wrote a column saying, I think this crisis is the perfect time where we should deal with windowing. And I think this is going to bring that to a fore that theaters, producers of movies and exhibitors will work together. And we're going to have to break down the windows because this situation is unprecedented. Before we could even have you on the show to talk about that, it's happening.
I think if that doesn't tell you about the incredible power I have in this town, nothing will. So let's just leave that where it is.
Well, first things first, what is happening to Variety? Are people working from home? Are there tech people who have to stay at work to keep the website up? Are you going to keep printing? Are you going to just focus on the web version? What's happening?
Well, Variety is still very much in operation, both web and print. The New York office closed last week. The LA office is closed this week, but you'd be surprised how much of a newsroom's operations can be conducted remotely. There's a lot of conversation, a lot of news still to cover. We're very much alive.
And is there anything in the back room? Like, are there people who have to be there just to keep the website up? Are there any tech people that need to be on site? Or is everybody working from home and you feel like you've been prepared and ready for something like this and it's working?
To my knowledge, everybody is at home. I don't think there's any part of our operations that can't be conducted remotely. There may be some deep technical stuff in terms of just, you know, the operation of computers and Wi-Fi and all that kind of stuff within the building, but I don't think anyone's there maintaining it this week.
It was just a couple of weeks ago that we were at the Globe Screen Conference. You were interviewing Greg Lemley, who is the owner and head of Lemley Theaters here in Los Angeles. It's an independent theater chain. It shows mostly independent art house films. I think their tagline is, we're not afraid of subtitles. And this was before, it was kind of on the verge of this panic here in the U.S., and maybe panic is the wrong word, but the wave of coronavirus quarantines and self-isolations. And there was a question about, well, what would happen if theaters close? Right now, theaters are not mandated to close, except when in certain cities, in certain states where governors and mayors have said so. Do you think that this will actually just become a national thing here in North America?
It's certainly looking that way. Obviously, we saw key closures yesterday in New York and Los Angeles. I don't know necessarily that every theater is going to close. I couldn't say that affirmatively, but I wouldn't be surprised. For how long is a big question. I mean, this is uncharted territory.
I had the feeling that all film and television production had shut down. But even today, we're still getting notices of this movie or that TV show is stopping. One movie stopped 5 days before it was completed. Unfortunately, on the TV series Batwoman, a production assistant just got seriously injured. So there is still a little bit of production activity, but I think by and large, it's pretty much ground to a halt, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it just, there is no production small enough to be safe from the contagion of coronavirus. And I think this is just an unprecedented blanket shutdown of production across the boards. The ramifications with, I think we're only beginning to understand for Hollywood.
Well, I think the one thing that's great is that everybody gets a pass. If your movie flops, ultimately, when it comes out, you can say, well, coronavirus. If it does great when it comes, see, the coronavirus. No matter what happens, your predictions or the film or TV property that you make, you get a pass for the next year because everything has been thrown up in the air. But one thing we know, we can speculate all we want, but one thing we know for certain, we're going to lose a month or more of box office. We saw what happened in China. That's still essentially shut down. We're going to lose a month or two of box office, if not more, and we're never going to get that back. Even if an individual film like Fast and Furious or James Bond can move and be positioned well and make all the money we would have expected it to make in its original release date, you can't get back 2 months out of the year. People aren't going to be able to go to the movies, or they're certainly going to go in much smaller numbers. And so there is going to be a hole in the box office worldwide this year, no matter what.
Oh, no question. I think we're already seeing that happen in a very big way after two weekends. There's no question this is going to be a multi-billion dollar loss for just the film industry. And that could be something that even extends past, you know, 10, 20, well, I don't know about 20, but you know, when you think about the global box office in 2019 was about $42 billion. The bulk of which was delivered by U.S. and lo and behold, China, where the impact will also be a multi-billion dollar one. I mean, this is going to be a very different number at the end of 2020 due to this crisis. And here's the thing, though. There's that short-term impact, which will be massive, but then you also have to ask the even more profound question of what happens when you've trained the audience to not go to the box office for months at a time, and as of today's news, we see NBC Universal putting some movies out day and date that could be available in homes. What does all this do to a audience habit that's been in place for decades and decades? I mean, that is the question.
Well, that actually is a very nice segue to what I was going to ask you about next, because amidst all of this, and we've been jumping around between topics here, but you wrote this piece that kind of summarized what's been going on with premium video on demand, which is the date, if not day and date release, then the kind of fast follow release of theatrical films into the home, but at a premium price, not for $3.99, but some people have said $40, other people have said $25, and now we have Universal saying it will be $20. And the conversations have gone nowhere for years, and there had been no conversations, according to NATO. There had been no conversations between studios and exhibitors, theater owners, for at least the last 2 years, at least none that were serious. And you suggested in a piece yesterday, well, if Bob Iger is taking over the chairmanship, his parting shot from Disney could be actually negotiating this premium video on demand window. Did you have any advice for him? Like, what were your what were the negotiating points, did you think?
Well, I would start from just the point of leverage, which is Disney is coming into this with more power than it's probably ever going to have. I mean, the 2019 box office, I think we have to presume, certainly by now, given the state of 2020, that it's Disney's riding a high that it's probably never going to reach again. And that gives them enormous ability to sort of dictate the terms of how we might see some innovation in film distribution. Now, before I say anything else, we have to also acknowledge the fact that Disney has a lot of reasons to not shake up the world of film distribution, because the current system of windows in terms of home entertainment, licensing pay TV globally and all that, it's been very good to them. But I think the circumstances and the sort of box office blackout that 2020 is going to be, a box office black hole, if you will, that innovation has to happen in that context. Disney has to lead the way. And I'm not going to sit here, nor I think is Disney going to sit here and say, here's the one way to do it. There should be a 30-day window. It costs $30 for all movies. No. What I'm saying is the season of experimentation has to begin now. Let's try a lot of different things. And what I'm really hoping is we're going to see other studios following NBC Universal's lead today and doing different things with different films. And then I think we are going to learn so much that we could build on.
Well, that's true. We can experiment and see what is it like when we release a movie and give a share of the profits to exhibitors. What's it like when we wait 15 days or 30 days or day and date? But Disney seems like the least likely studio to do that. And in fact, I feel like they'll just be saying, oh, you're at home for a couple of weeks. Why not subscribe to Disney Plus?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. because you could argue they could have their cake and eat it too, the best of the old world and the best of the new world. But I think even Disney is going to find itself curious to get the data that will come from experimenting in the way that I think the Frozen 2 example is at least a small experiment. I'd love to see them do something bigger. I'd like to see, look, no one is suggesting that they do this with Mulan. No one is suggesting, you know, NBC Universal do this with Fast and Furious 9. I think, though, that they're on the lower end of the film food chain, like the Trolls World Tour animated program that I think is going to be the prime beneficiary of this new NBC Universal strategy. I think once they start doing some work there and some real experimentation, it's going to become more the norm. I really believe that if we see multiple studios out there with product like this, consumer expectations of how movies get to homes is going to change. And then by then, I think it becomes something that takes on a momentum on its own. And I think maybe eventually, years out, we are talking about the Fast and Furious Nines of the world, the movies of the biggest production value that you would think really need to be in the theaters. I think by then the Disney Pluses of the world will be globally everywhere. Perhaps we'll have some financial flexibility where some people are paying $6 a month, but maybe you're paying $20 a month because you could also get movies day and date with your Disney Plus subscription. This is what I think we have begun the road on today. And that's exciting.
And Sperling, that scares the hell out of exhibitors, doesn't it?
Well, yes. And you mentioned that Frozen 2 was moved up, actually, from after 114 days in theaters. Disney Plus, Frozen 2 was put onto Disney Plus by Disney, I think about 3 months early. And it was kind of a, hey, don't worry, look, you can watch Frozen 2 all of a sudden. And I think theater owners were saying, look, it's fine. But the thought process might be from the exhibition side, from the cinema operator side, well, gee, here we are down. We can't operate. We still have overhead, such as rent and utilities and things that we have to pay for, some fixed costs. And you're kicking us while we're down, and then you're kind of turning the knife a little bit because, we can't even operate, and you're pulling the product off our shelves and kind of selling it in your own stores. So I would agree with you. I do think that, Michael, that I do think that theater operators may not like this. I don't necessarily know if there's been any conversation between the NATOs of the world or the CNCs of the world and studios. I do know that in France, CNC, which oversees that industry there, has said we will waive the windowing. They have very strict laws in France about that, that you can take a theatrical film and release it, what they're calling e-cinema, but really it's VOD. But right. I guess my question is, well, what's going to happen down the road when studios return to theaters and say, well, we'd like 65% for the next Marvel movie? I get the distinct impression that, depending on the studio, that the pushback will be, well, how about 20% since you're going to be selling it somewhere else really quickly?
Yeah, that will become the big negotiation. I mean, by the way, let's just bring it back to today and today's news from NBC Universal. Do the exhibitors, do NATO, did they even know this announcement was coming? Now that it's out there, whether they knew it or not, are they going to be vocal in opposition? I can't see how they would, given that their business is practically, in hibernation mode. But on the other hand, they must see the forces that this is going to unleash, and how can they stand by and let that happen? So that, to me, is one thing. I think then to sort of spin that forward, going back to your question, the exhibitors are going to have to figure out with the studios a financial arrangement that, let's even forget day and date, because I think that becomes too aggressive once the theaters are back in operation. But if there are windows that limit the 90-day window down to 30, down to 15, forget about what that price point is, what cut do the exhibitors get of that? Because they're going to have to get a cut to make this work. unless they're going to be somehow taken out of the equation entirely, which I don't think is possible. I do think theaters have a long-term place in culture to play for a long time. I just think it's going to be a smaller piece of the pie. And so this negotiation is going to become, and by the way, this negotiation is not new. This negotiation has been happening on and off for 15 years, has yielded very little agreement, has yielded a few experiments here and there that really haven't told us enough. And we've got to get past that phase. We've got to get to a place where the negotiation intensifies, where experiments are out in the marketplace and the data is coming back. And then I think it does come together.
Exhibitors are always saying, we get this percentage of the grosses. Now they're just going to be saying, maybe we should extend that to premium video on demand. We get 42% or 45% or 40. Maybe it should include whatever money you make at that next level.
Yeah. Those percentages, I couldn't even guess at this point about how that's going to break out. But also, don't forget, you know, you mentioned Disney Plus earlier. Well, the theater companies themselves sort of see themselves in that business too. When AMC at the end of last year launched a product that was not, you know, day and date content, but content that's sort of consistent with what you get, say, on iTunes and the home entertainment window, well, they could easily bring that to a place where they are doing day and date on their own services. So, do they get a piece of this, or is it just available on one streaming service like a Disney Plus? Do the cable operators have an ability to get in on this? Does a Charter get to be able to offer a film? Does an Amazon get to offer a film that's day and date in the same way that they currently enable people to pay for HBO on top of Amazon Prime? There is so much complexity here, and how they're going to work it out has to start, and I think it will.
Yeah, my question about the story, of course, Universal is releasing Trolls World Tour on April 10th on premium video on demand for $20. It was going to come out in theaters. Now it's going straight to premium video on demand. That'll be for a 48-hour rental fee, not to own it. And my first question was, do exhibitors know about this? Was it licensed already? I assume deals were already made. So it'll be interesting to see, like you say, whether they'll actually object or say, well, these are unusual circumstances. We're not going to make a fuss, but let's not think that this is the way of the future.
Well, I can tell you that, and this is only anecdotally, of course. However, several theater operators, they're independent, they're overseas, all kind of got in touch via Twitter to ask whether myself or any of the other folks at Celluloid Junkie knew about this decision regarding Universal to releasing Trolls specifically, you know, to premium VOD. And I said, well, no, I didn't. And the response was, well, I guess it's, we have to make a decision now whether we support this film and the planned April 6th date or not. And the April 6th date is the April 6th release date theatrically. They have trailers for that film up in their theaters now. Now, granted, their theaters
are shutting down.
Are shutting down.
Shut down for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Right. So it's like, okay, what do you, you know, you may have been supporting it, but doesn't matter. You're not going to be supporting it moving forward anyway, which is precisely why it would seem Universal made this decision.
I didn't even think it was possible for Universal to do this, like legally. No. Without the sign off of the exhibitors. I mean, but who knows what the legal, I mean, again, I'm a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer. I'm saying hypothetically, I'm a lawyer for the exhibitors here. The question is, if I am not literally open, do I still have rights to keep NBC Universal from showing something outside the theater while I'm closed? I don't know the answer to that. But certainly some lawyer at NBC Universal does know that answer.
Well, I thought your comment about Bob Iger, I couldn't remember his name for a moment there, that it would be his career's masterstroke, and I'm quoting there, if he were able to get premium VOD and or some other form of windowing kind of resolved finally after, as you mentioned, 15, 20 years of negotiations, it would be kind of a nice little feather in his cap on the way out the door, if not, you know, his, well, as you say, career's masterstroke.
I'll go one further. I would say it would be the entertainment industry equivalent of bringing peace to the Middle East. It would be getting the Israelis and the Palestinians to hammer out a deal.
Well, we're wondering what the long-term impact will be. We know there's going to be a pileup of movies, but they'll space out down the road. Movies will be repositioned. Movie-going habits. I think after, if there is a shutdown or after 2 months of being at home, I imagine people will be delighted to get back out in the world and go to the movie theater again and see movies on a big screen and get out of the house. So I don't know if it's going to, you know, wildly change their habits. People are already used to watching movies and TV shows in the home, even on demand. So this isn't going to be anything new for them, except that they're forced to do it. And I think if anything, maybe you look at some of the streamers like Apple and Disney Plus, they have a little bare cupboard. And I think people will quickly realize there's not a lot there. Whereas Netflix and Hulu, they have a much deeper library. So that might help them.
Yeah, I think there's no question Netflix is a beneficiary of this period. And I think all the streaming services potentially could really get a lift, as so many consumers are going to be essentially trapped in their homes. They've got no sports to watch. It's almost as if the streaming services were built for this, and it'll be interesting to see if they, in particular, market to that sort of new reality, sobering as it is. But I want to get back to what you said, and I agree with it, which is I think some people will be eager once they've been left out of the theaters for months. I think there will be a huge pent-up demand to get back to the theaters. I think the theaters will market to that in a big way. But I do also think there will be a countervailing force where, especially among young people, they will be essentially trained to meet their movie and entertainment needs entirely in the home. And I don't know that that moves away even in the long term after a short-term surge return back to the theaters. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, this has always been my theory or my argument, which is you need to get a younger generation going to the movies. And this was long before this coronavirus outbreak. It was for the past 5 years I've been saying my kids love going to the movies because I love going to the movies, but most people are just staying home and their kids are staying home. And therefore what you have, not now, maybe not 10 years from now, but 20 years from now, is a really steep decline in movie going, much the way, young people don't go to operas for the most part.
I don't think it'll ever be that bad, but...
wow, that's really bad.
I went right off the cliff, yeah.
You know, here's the thing, I think, for the theater business, and I think it's something that has disappeared from the conversation for a while, but I think needs to come back, which is, I think what really makes the theater business live or die in the long term is the quality of the experience, not just in the venue, and we could talk about things like nice seating and get dinner at my movie. That's one element, but also in terms of the on-screen experience. I feel like that conversation has ended, as if like there's no other enhancements beyond like what we've seen with 3D, which of course really wasn't much. But I still hold out hope that the exhibition business will figure out technologies that will make coming together for the communal experience really, really valuable in a way that cannot be replicated in the home.
You don't see that right now with the tremendous visual quality. When I was a kid going to the movies, we had celluloid, which is a great experience, but they were often scratchy after a few weeks. You go to see Star Wars 4 months into the run, it's scratchy, it's a rough print. Sound wasn't great. The sound bleeded in from the next theater. I feel like theaters have done a great job in terms of just the actual quality of the experience in terms of picture and sound. It seems to me like we're in a golden age. Everybody's got their own seat. You got a good sight line. You got great sound and picture 99% of the time. I'm pretty happy about that.
And I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I'm saying there's always room for improvement. There's always room for innovations that maybe you and I aren't even necessarily even thinking about that haven't necessarily even been invented yet. I don't want to get that grandiose, but mm-hmm. I just think there is more that could be done with the in-theater experience that could give it a specialness that ensures, while I do think it will inevitably shrink as a business, it won't go away anytime soon.
And we don't need to prop up entertainment companies' stock, but while everybody's going to take a hit from this quarter or who knows what, if you're looking at a Disney or a Universal or Warner Brothers, whatever its fundamental value was a month before this happened, look, 6 months, a year down the road, these companies are still going to be in a great position. They're still good companies. Nothing has fundamentally changed. We'll get back to somewhat normal again, and people will go to the movies again, and their business will thrive, whether it's in the home on premium video on demand or at the movie theaters or wherever. So I don't see why anybody would say, oh, I want to sell this stock, unless you're just a short-term player who's just gambling on where the stock is going to be tomorrow or next week.
It's hard not to. The bottom line is, it's hard not to look at what's going on right now and see it as the beginning of a sea change in some shape or form. It doesn't mean like some sort of overnight transformation, but on the road to big changes.
And among them may be some new technology and ways of presenting movies to people more directly than they've ever had before.
We can only hope.
Where's James Cameron when you need him?
But it actually, you're nailing the right person. We need a little more of Cameron's vision, his eye for technology. Not, you know, the technology conversation nowadays is so focused on streaming and distribution and basically the old wine in new bottles. And I think there's more to say in terms of what could be new wine for new bottles, or, oh my God, I'm destroying the metaphor here, but like a new bottle in a different bar, you know?
Even though the bars are shut down. Even though the bars are shut down.
Right.
Well, you know, certainly if there's one place to turn to find all of what's about to happen, whether it's next week or in an hour or in 3 months, it's Variety and Variety.com. And certainly I highly suggest picking up the print publication because it is beautifully published with its perfect bound. It's nice. And I don't want to say glossy because that makes it sound like a grocery store magazine, but it's just a beautiful publication. And these days it's, at least if you're in the entertainment industry, you really need to be checking out Variety.com and its sister sites. I guess Deadline is also a sister site, and IndieWire. I don't know how much, is there a lot of back and forth between the different companies, or is it everybody's in their own box?
Everyone's in their own box. We're friendly rivals when we're talking about Deadline and we're talking about IndieWire. And thanks for the love on the magazine, even though I have not worked on it in the past year. I'm gonna throw one more plug in. You're going to see a new product come from the Variety family in the coming weeks. This was something that was planned long in advance before the coronavirus crisis. It's going to be called Variety Intelligence Platform. It's going to be a new subscription market research service that digs deep into the matter, into what matters to the industry most. Thinking about long form special reports on big issues like the streaming wars, all sorts of data, commentary, a very complimentary mix to the Variety.com experience. And we're very excited about it.
What form does it come in?
It is a non-print format, though you could certainly print it out. It's going to be a website that will be part of the Variety.com experience. It will be a subscription extension to that experience. And yes, there'll be a newsletter component. Yes, there'll be special reports in PDF form with incredible data, short form commentaries about what's going on in the business, the very latest. And, you know, I think it's something that people at a time in the publishing business where more and more readers are accustomed to perhaps paying for an additional layer of content, we think it's going to resonate, especially at a time where even prior to the pandemic crisis, everything is changing in big ways in this business. And I think everyone sort of that's in this business needs to engage at a deeper level. And I think that's what Variety Intelligence Platform, which you could call VIP, will be all about.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a chance for some really in-depth coverage to catch your breath and do some big thinking rather than that daily hustle to get out the latest news. Sounds like it's going to be some really substantive in-depth reporting and thoughtful long-term thinking rather than just what happened last hour.
Exactly. Well, we'll get Last Hour and 10 years from now. We'll do them both.
Well, certainly, I know I'm checking, you know, what you guys are publishing every hour, because it literally is changing every hour.
Don't you feel like just sitting here, we've probably missed some sort of big news that may have changed the entire nature of our conversation, but that's the way the world flows these days.
I know. And I feel bad because normally, we record these segments, it takes 15 minutes and it's really quick, but now we've been talking for, I don't even know how long. And the whole time I'm thinking, oh my God, the whole world could have changed in the last 10 minutes. We should probably let him go. So thank you very much, Andrew, for taking the time to join us. And I guess, where can we find you besides variety.com? Of course, you're on Twitter at A Wallenstein.
Correct.
And of course you have a podcast as well.
Strictly Business, and we're going to keep cranking them out in the coming weeks. Lots of great conversations with industry people of all stripes. We just hit our 100th episode a few weeks ago.
Well, thank you very, very much for taking the time to join us, especially on such short notice. And with all that's going on, I'm speaking for Michael here, but I truly appreciate it.
Anytime.
Well, as you know, Michael, I've been singing Andrew Wallenstein's praises for a long time, since as long as I've known him, really. And it's always great to speak with him. So I was really glad that he got back to us and was able to join us on such short notice. I mean, literally less than 24 hours ago, less than 12 hours ago, I emailed him and he got right back to us. So I greatly appreciate him taking the time to join us.
It was a lot of fun to hear his point of view. And of course, we have a brief obituary. It's kind of sad. The DC Movie Palace, the Uptown Theater, has been abruptly closed. AMC has sort of vacated their lease. The gorgeous Art Deco Movie Palace called the Uptown Theater is apparently owned by a family. It's been in their trust or something for many years. It's located in Washington, DC, and it's privately owned by a family, but AMC has been operating it for years. Now they've suddenly walked away from their lease, which ends in March. And now the family's at loose ends. They'd love to see the Film Shrine continue, but aren't sure it can happen. For reasons of politics, DC's often been a third major city where movies make their premieres and limited releases. Like, you open up in New York and LA, a lot of times you'll often be in DC. And the Uptown Theater has hosted many premieres over the years, including the world premiere of 2001, A Space Odyssey. It's the equivalent in importance to the now shuttered Ziegfeld in New York or Grauman's Chinese Theater in L.A. Different style of film, of palace, but still that type of landmark. What a shame that it's gone away, and hopefully they'll be able to rescue it somehow. Maybe Quentin Tarantino can do it, or who's a big DC filmmaker? I don't know.
I don't know that there are big DC filmmakers.
I don't think there are, no.
I think CNN is a big DC.
That's true. Yeah, they could premiere their CNN docs there all the time, just like pick it up like Netflix did with the Paris here in New York.
Not for a while, because if it's a movie palace, it probably seats about 1,200 people, and that's way beyond the social distancing regulations that are being put in place.
That's right. So that wraps it up for the Uptown Theater, and that perhaps wraps it up for our show.
Yeah, normally, of course, we'd like I said at the head of the show, we would have
you teased this email 3 weeks ago.
Oh my gosh.
The whole world has changed, and you're like, oh, I've been a terrible person. That poor man or woman is wondering where the heck their email is.
Yes, and this is an email, and this is a tease for you to go back and listen to some of our podcasts. And I think it was 3 weeks ago, you talked about how shooting a film in black and white is different than shooting a film in color.
So what did they have to say? Did you find it?
I'd have to go back and look.
Oh, my God.
I received so, how many emails I get.
Yes, and you look at none of them.
That's not true. I look at some of them.
I apologize to whomever you are in black and white or color. I know you're right, and I was wrong, and I appreciate you taking time to write
in. Actually, they said everybody's right and wrong.
Oh, yeah. Well, hopefully someday we'll find out your wisdom, and Sperling will clarify it to us.
But if you do want to write to us, you can, dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
Why would they, since they know you won't be able to find their email?
I promise. I'm going to go. Look, I have a lot of time to go through all my email now.
And this is the time for us to set up a donate button. They're just sitting at home going, I love Showbiz Sandbox. Thank God I had that podcast to keep me sane.
That's true. And you should send us your money via carrier pigeon or
Venmo.
Venmo, yeah. Again, our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail, and please do. We're kind of lonely now. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter at showbizsandbox is our handle, and we are really updating that a little bit more frequently given all the news that's happening. And we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com, although hopefully they can be found at home where they should be self-isolating. Michael Gilt can be found at home self-isolating, but also online. And every week he's got something new and another new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's staffordact.gov.
Oh, look that up because that's probably coming down the pike. Martial law is not spelled M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L.
Anyway, keep going.
But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com? Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice and stay healthy.